All right, welcome back. Every time I hear the numbers run, you know, the call-in numbers, I got to remind everybody, I used to live across the street here from the studio, right here in Sherman Oaks, and they would run the numbers, and my phone number, when I lived across the street, was one digit off. And I used to look across the, you know, across the street over here at Coast and think about that, and here I am, 20 years later, hearing that same phone number. It's pretty crazy. Have you read this? Aliens are controlling the sun. UFO hunters now say that they have spotted strange ships near the solar surface in the latest crazy claim. You've got to check it out. Read the full story right now over at coasttocoastam.com. Just click on the news section and check it out, and check out the pictures too as well. Absolutely fascinating. Our guest tonight is Dr. Michael Sala. Right before the break, we were discussing Antarctica, Admiral Byrd, Operation High Jump, the way that all of this was tied together in 1947 with not only William Rhodes in Phoenix and Kenneth Arnold and Roswell, but the Antarctica expedition and the sightings down there. Who is piloting all of this? Well, William Tompkins has come forward as a whistleblower. Michael Sala just got back from interviewing him in San Diego, and we're going to discuss all of this, plus your phone calls, right after this short break. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We're talking with Dr. Michael Sala tonight. We'll be taking your calls next. Michael, now, as we start to put all of this together, I think it's an important thing to talk about and start to mention that all of the testimony from Corey Good and David Wilcock and others is starting to line up with what Tompkins has been talking about and with his documents as well through the Navy and what they were designing and allegedly is now actually flying.
It does. It aligns very well because William Tompkins, he was involved in the R&D side of the secret space programs, whereas Corey Good and others were involved in the operational side of the Solar Warden and the other space programs. Tompkins was involved since his assignments with the Navy and through the various aerospace companies. He was involved in the designing and in the development of the architectural blueprints for building these spacecraft, these battle fleets, and then the final operational development of them which led to them being launched. The first two space battle fleets were launched in 1984, according to Tompkins. And that coincided with Tompkins working for General Dynamics from 1981 to 84. So Tompkins' career has moved through various aerospace companies, and he has documentation substantiating the work he did with these companies and also substantiating his claims about the development of these Navy space battle fleets. And this is really one of the critical things here, is that it was really took all those years, we're talking like three decades, from the time Tompkins says that he developed the initial designs for these Navy ships in the 1950s. It took 30 years for them to be actually developed and then eventually built. And it was in 84. He says that there were eight space battle groups that were built for the Navy. They launched the first two in 1984, and then another six launched throughout the 80s. And that these battle fleets have been in operation ever since.
I'm looking at over at your website. I'm looking at the Naval Spacecraft Carrier, Douglas Aircraft Advanced Design, 1954. Can you describe that? And the way that it looks when you hear about, well, I'll let you describe it because the witness and photographs and films over the years of cigar-shaped craft, this is exactly what this resembles here. Can you describe this craft and how big is it?
Sure. Well, that's one of the 2-kilometer-long craft. That's the space carrier, which is basically the core of the space battle group. Tompkins said that the way in which it operated was that that the Navy would basically receive these unsolicited proposals for these different spacecraft. Tompkins basically said that the way he operated was that, you know, rather than the Navy coming to him and telling him, you know, we want you to build this type of design this type of ship and that type of ship, he said that basically he was given the parameters for the mission parameters. He said that was the way in which he designed ships for the Navy. The Navy said, okay, well, our goal is to basically form a concentric protective grid around the solar system and the neighboring 12 solar systems around us. And so based on that, Tompkins then went ahead and developed designs for a space Navy battle group that would fulfill the function of basically creating a concentric set of, groups surrounding our solar system in 12 strategic locations. And so once he came up with these designs, then the Navy looked at them and then gave the approval, and funding was there, and then it went to the next level of the kind of architectural plans being put together. And one of the things that Tompkins showed me, and also I should mention Dr. Robert Wood, who really is a key person in bringing out Tompkins' testimony. Robert Wood has been working with Bill Tompkins since 2009 and was the editor for his book, Selected by Extraterrestrials. And the interesting thing about Dr. Wood is that he worked for 43 years at McDonnell Douglas, and he worked at the same time as Bill Tompkins at the forerunner to McDonnell Douglas, which obviously was a merger. You know, before then, it was just known as Douglas Aircraft Corporation. And Wood worked at Douglas, and actually the boss of Dr. Wood was working under the two people that Tompkins was directly working with. And these were, as I mentioned earlier, a Dr. Klemperer and an Elmer Wheaton. You know, both of them were involved in research in anti-gravity, and Dr. Wood worked under them in terms of his boss being under these two people. So Wood was able to confirm that, in fact, Tompkins did actually work at Douglas under these people that, you know, we know now from the documentation actually were working on anti-gravity. So, yes, Dr. Wood is a very important part of Bill Tompkins' testimony, just because he also worked at Douglas and has been very interested in the UFO phenomenon ever since.
So this design that I'm looking at here, the 1954 Douglas Aircraft Advanced Design, it specifically calls this part of a battle fleet. So this craft here, which is quite large, this was armed?
That's this. There were two designs here. You know, one was the elliptical shaped or the cigar shaped space carrier.
Right.
The primary function was to carry the anti-gravity scout craft, if you like, and then the space cruiser, which had all the advanced weapons that the Navy was aware of at the time and was building at the time. Now, you know, this is where it kind of gets to be very, very interesting, because according to Tompkins, the Navy was being helped by Nordic extraterrestrials, that throughout this entire period in the 1950s, he says that there were Nordic extraterrestrials that actually had infiltrated into the Douglas Aircraft Company and were giving Tompkins assistance in coming up with the designs for these battle groups. And basically, they were doing this because they wanted the United States to develop its own space program to be a counterweight to the program that had been developed in conjunction between the Nazis and the reptilian extraterrestrials. Because basically, it's like in the kind of galactic politics, the reptilians and the Nordic extraterrestrials are typically on competing sides in various galactic conflicts, and the Earth was drawn into this, and so throughout the Second World War, while the Nazis were being overtly helped by reptilians, the Allied forces were being covertly helped by these Nordic extraterrestrials, and that continued throughout Tompkins' time at Douglas Aircraft, and he kind of discusses that in great detail in his book Selected by Extraterrestrials.
Well, and he's got kind of two different problems on his hands. Number one, he has got documents, and number two, he's got the rest of it by memory, because that was his job in 1942 to 1945, was to remember these things. Why hasn't he been silenced, or is he part of the disclosure that the government is trying to impose?
Well, this is very interesting, because he says that what happened was that in 2001, he approached a Navy admiral who was the executive director of a group called the Navy League,
right,
a national organization, and the admiral, Hugh Webster, he looked at what Tompkins had written. Tompkins at the time had written about a third of his book, and basically told Tompkins, yes, go ahead and tell your story, reveal everything that happened to you. So he didn't try to shut down Tompkins at all. It was like Tompkins was given the go-ahead to reveal everything. And ever since that time, Tompkins has continued to have the support of the Navy. He continues to attend Navy meetings. And as recently as 2 weeks ago, there was a meeting out at San Diego. It's called West 2016. And it is the premier Navy aerospace gathering, at least on the West Coast, with many hundreds of top aerospace corporation executives and admirals and captains all meeting to discuss things. And Tompkins says that these meetings are often used to try to help the secret space programs learn about the latest R&D and how that's going to be integrated into their space battle groups. And so this is something that Tompkins still has his security clearance. He's still given access to some of the high-level meetings, dealing with these space programs. And Tompkins has agreed with me when I've asked him, well, does this mean that you're part of a U.S. Navy-sanctioned disclosure initiative? He said yes.
Well, and that's my point. Here he's attending these meetings. He still has his secret clearance that he needs to attend these meetings with. His book, which is titled Selected by Extraterrestrials, they are aware of this. So that says a lot about Tompkins himself, about his background and how he can be trusted about what he is saying, because they are letting the book publish and they haven't revoked his credentials.
That's a very good point there, Jimmy. That's very critical. So for anyone that's involved in anything to do with government, if you do something that the government doesn't like, that's the first thing they pull is your security clearance, because then that means the end of your career. But in fact, Tompkins, as I said, up until 2 weeks ago, West 2016 conference, Tompkins attended. So that means that he is genuinely doing what he's doing with the full approval of people in the Navy that understand and have been kind of read into these top secret programs.
What have you done to explore the possibility that maybe everything that he is disclosing is 100% disinformation, and that he is a tool, and that they are using him for this?
Well, you know, that's always something you need to consider. But the thing is, you know, straight off the bat, like just the involvement of Dr. Robert Wood,
right,
who did work at Douglas. So, you know, Dr. Wood vetted Tompkins very closely, because Dr. Wood is really the premier document specialist, especially when it comes to these covert programs. You know, many people are aware of the Majestic documents, which Dr. Wood has vetted along with his son, Ryan. And Dr. Wood basically vetted Tompkins very rigorously. And, you know, I mean, the guy worked for McDonnell Douglas for 43 years. And, you know, he has a PhD, and he was kind of a top-notch scientist. So he knew the kind of questions that needed to be asked to vet him. And at the end, Dr. Wood was so impressed with Tompkins' replies and knowledge of what was going on that he said, well, you know, I'm going to help you get your information out. It's just so good. It's so important. And so he said that he would be, he took up the job of being the editor of Tompkins' book.
Now,
so I'm very confident that Tompkins' information is very genuine and is not part of some kind of disinformation program.
Operation High Jump has been one of the most discussed subjects in our circles, except there's just not a lot of information out there. We have a couple of newspaper releases that are, you know, decades old now. You've got a couple of quotes purported to have come from Admiral Byrd. Are we on the brink of some major disclosure coming from Tompkins about actually what did occur down in Antarctica?
Well, what Tompkins has revealed of Antarctica is based on what he has heard from other sources. That is not something he was directly involved in at the time. This was kind of in between the time when he was working for Navy intelligence and when he began working with different aerospace companies in the 1948. 47-48 was when he started working with Lockheed and Northrop, and then eventually moved on to Douglas. So he heard about the Operation High Jump during his time at Douglas, but it's not information that he directly experienced. So I don't think he's going to be the key to Operation High Jump being revealed. I think he's the key to, you know, one, that the U.S. Navy had received all of this information about Nazi anti-gravity technologies. And the thing here, I think it's very important, is that those debriefings that Tompkins heard over that four-year period, and he said that, you know, he personally delivered these packages to different aerospace companies on, you know, over 1,000 times in that four-year period, that these debriefings eventually were taken up into the space programs as a database of information about what had happened during the kind of you know, during that Nazi era. And it corresponds very much with what Corey Good says that he accessed on the smart glass pads from 1987 to 2007. So I think that those smart glass pad briefing documents were based on what Tompkins had earlier seen or heard when he was working for Navy intelligence.
We'll talk about those smart pads right after the break. Our guest tonight is Dr. Michael E. Salla. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Your calls next. Welcome back. Check this out. The oldest known chameleon has been discovered in a piece of amber. You remember, like Jurassic Park. In Myanmar and Southeast Asia, the fossil dated to 100 million years ago. It's an incredible 78 million years older than the previous oldest chameleon on record. Check out the story. You can read the full story right now at coasttocoastam.com. Our guest tonight is Dr. Michael Salla. We're talking about whistleblowers. We're talking about Corey Good. And of course, William Tompkins and his amazing, not only documents, but story that is starting to make the rounds right now. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Your phone calls with Dr. Michael Sala when we come back after this short break. You stay right there. Welcome back to Coast AM. Our guest tonight is Dr. Michael Sala. We're talking about whistleblowers and his conversation and interviews that he just finished here in San Diego with William Tompkins. And of course, his recent disclosure with Corey Good, too, as well. Michael, you want to take some phone calls?
Sure.
All right, let's see. Let's go to east of the Rockies. Let's go to Dale out in Jacksonville, Florida. Dale, welcome to Coast AM.
Hey, guys. Great show.
Hi, Dale.
It's, you know, I kind of don't want to say anything. I do have a question. I'd like to make a statement. It's kind of general. You know, I'm a conservative guy. Got family, all that good stuff. I think most things are positive or negative. You know, my personal opinion on UFOs is I think there's different types. My dad believed in this in the 70s. I remember as a kid we'd talk about it. We'd look at the Bible. We'd, you know, read whatever. And I think it's a spiritual being. But Scripture tells us if something appears as an angel of light, we should test it and prove it. Whether it's a physical being or dimensional, I don't know. So I guess my question is, there's different areas in the globe that are known to be more active, maybe spiritually or powers or whatever. Stonehenge is pretty interesting. We got places in Florida. I mentioned to the screener, you know, about the coral garden, I think, that the guy made for his wife, or maybe she...
Yeah, the coral castle, yes.
Yeah. There's stories of him, a delivery truck, old days, you know, like whenever he built it, 1800, whatever it was, would arrive with a big piece of block, and he'd have the driver go around, you know, on the other side or somewhere, and it would be offloaded, right? So, again, I guess my question is to Dr. Michael, man, great info. I'm a kook like everybody. I'm a conspiracy guy. I'm a religious guy. I'm a father. You know, all that good stuff. But just wanted your opinions on points on the globe. You know, and I don't want to slam the Masonic order. My grandfather was a Mason. God bless him. He's passed. But there are certain areas. You think about the pyramids, right? There's power there. It's been proven that things grow better in a pyramid. Anyway.
Yeah. No, we understand the question, and thank you for the call, Dale. Michael, what do you think about that? The hot spots for UFO activity around the world, but also being tied to specific megalithic or historical sites.
You know, it's a vast question. You know, the number of kind of hot spots or energy vortices on the planet, their connection with UFOs, extraterrestrial life, it really is a vast question. And it's something that I've been trying to understand since I got into this field in 2001. And people like Corey Good and William Tompkins, you know, they give us information that helps put together all of the pieces in the puzzle. And I can say, you know, right now, honestly, that I feel as though I'm getting a much better overall understanding on this complex issue. But to really grasp it in its fullest, I think we need to have some kind of, well, full disclosure. All the information needs to come out. Because, you know, one of the things that I think is very clear from what Tompkins and Good and others have said is that we are a galactic culture. There's no doubt about it, that we have reached that level of technological sophistication. But the problem is that it's only a select percentage of humanity, a very small percentage of humanity, that have been read into these programs, that have been given the opportunity to train, to be recruited into these programs, to kind of like interact with different extraterrestrial species, and to learn from this vast possibility of us being related genetically with all of these different races. And so, yes, you know, we are a galactic civilization, and I think that that information, the total disclosure, is needed so that we become fully aware of our real history, and just kind of like this becomes common knowledge so that we all have the opportunity to do these kinds of interactions and have these experiences that Corey Good and others have been describing.
Let's go to Wild Card. Let's go Gary right here in Santa Maria, California. Gary, welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Oh, thank you very much. Real quick background, because I don't talk to you often. I've been doing about 14 consciousness experiments with George, taking a favorite company that I won't mention and asking the intention to put the stock price down, and it's gone into the basement. Even a formal projection that their earnings are going to be lower. They're heavily involved with GMO research. I won't name them. George is getting a little bugged about that. Wildly successful, but then the last couple of times I've been on the air with George and also three other hosts, there's been sun flares popping up. And so I started doing some retroactive research, and it seems that when there's a select group of astrologers or Alex Jones or other highly charged emotional people on, there seems to be sun flares surrounding coast to coast. Now, if we as a country, and I hearken back to the remote viewer Ingo Swann, who was not limited to this planet, and also Russell Targ, who classified aliens into five different types, one that wanted us absolutely dead because they are more powerful short range, but through the process of remote viewing, which is like opening up a wormhole, and I think wormholes work in loops, not straight lines, but if we had the ability of opening up a wormhole close to a sunspot that could either kill our planet or maybe kill, quote-unquote, their planet, who would be holding who hostage? And my debate now with George is, with our own sun, do we concentrate and take the risk of exciting an existing sunspot, or wait till an existing sunspot goes off like an AK-47 like it did on the last time I was on
okay.
your show?
Okay, all right. Fair enough. Michael, well, what about the... like the sunspot and the aircraft, the spacecraft that have been seen around the sun lately? There's been lots of it. Any of the whistleblowers that you're in contact with talk about that?
Well, yes, that's a very interesting question. The sunspots or the sun seems to be some kind of conduit for some of these more advanced extraterrestrial craft. That they are able to move through the sun, appear in our solar system, just basically, I guess, entering from some distant part of the galaxy into whether it's a black hole or another sun, and then kind of like just appearing and coming out of our sun. There have been kind of photos or images of craft leaving the sun or using energy from the sun, so that is very significant. I don't think, though, as far as the kind of secret space programs, the Solar Warden program, that they have yet reached that level of technology to be able to kind of use the sun as a conduit to travel through the galaxy. So I guess in terms of where we are probably, at least as far as the secret space programs are concerned, they are very much a Type 1 civilization. Those that travel through the sunspots are, of course, a Type 2 civilization. And those that are imposing some kind of solar system-wide blockade or frequency grid or quarantine, we might consider them to be a type 3 ET civilization.
Let's jump around the country a little bit. Let's go east of the Rockies. David in Indianapolis, Indiana. David, Naptown, welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, I was kind of wondering if we have our space extraterrestrials helping us when Germany has a different breed and they seem to be some sort of balance. I'm trying to figure out what's NATO, and we haven't seen any of these weapons used in any of our conflicts. Is this just a big play? Are we just entertainment for a higher order out there?
That's a great question, David. Yes. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for that question, David. I think it's a very important question. I think that there seem to be, based on all of these testimonies, whistleblower testimonies about secret space programs and different ET groups being involved, it seems that some ET groups, we might describe them as being more along the lines of the kind of service to self orientation, tend to directly intervene in human affairs. And as we saw with the Nazis, that a reptilian group helped them with the purpose of the Nazis actually winning the war and going on to kind of like conquer the planet. That's according to what Tompkins has said. And then there's another group being of extraterrestrials that were covertly helping the U.S. Navy and NATO and other powers to prevent these kinds of takeover efforts by these kind of more service-to-self extraterrestrials such as the reptilians. So I think there is a kind of balancing going on between different sides of these extraterrestrials that have been interacting with humanity over the last century, either covertly or overtly. And so, in a way, we are very much part of a galactic-wide conflict that has not been resolved. And, we on the Earth, when we do finally have some kind of full disclosure, we're going to learn that the galaxy is as messed up as our planet is.
Was that the first reference, about reptilians in 1942 to 1945 that you can recall?
Yes. Tompkins is basically saying that these Navy spies were talking about reptilians
right.
in 1942.
Right.
That's kind of decades before the first references to reptilian extraterrestrials.
I mean, in popular culture, in movies, in books, magazines, it didn't happen for quite a long time. For that to happen in 1942 to 1945 kind of makes you wonder.
Yeah, and Tompkins was very clear. He said that these Navy guys, they were all kind of very young. They were really didn't know how to handle this information, what they were hearing about these reptilian-looking beings that were helping the Nazis. But they were acting in this capacity as consultants, basically giving them the information they needed to move forward with developing their technologies and weapon systems.
Let's go back to this coast. Let's go to Wildcard Tommy in Corona, California. Tommy, welcome to Coast AM.
This is Tommy speaking. And my question is, what are the capacity levels in the main ship that is out there that's over 2 kilometers long, and how many tactical vehicles does it contain, and what's the crew level?
Thank you so much for the phone call, Tommy. I was wondering the very same thing, Michael, when I was looking at the drawings, because they have the cubes are stacked up, and those are 20 feet by 20 feet, and some are 10 feet, right? The ship itself is huge.
Well, that's right, yes. It's a couple of kilometers long. That's not a question I actually have asked Bill Tompkins, how many craft were on there, how many personnel they could fit. But obviously any craft that's a couple of kilometers long, we're talking about many thousands of personnel. that could fit on there. But yeah, I don't have those specific details. That's something I'll have to remember that next time I talk to him.
Yeah, it's an absolutely fascinating point because you can fit because, well, there's references in the drawing about scout aircraft, or I keep saying aircraft, scout craft on the ship. Any indication on how big those scout craft were?
He said that there were many different designs of craft, all sorts of craft. He said that the Navy basically had, from the 50s to the 60s, accepted designs for up to 100 different types of craft. So these space carriers, they could carry some, quite a number of different craft. Some of the sizes that Tompkins mentioned for the various craft that were built as kind of auxiliary or built as a support ship, he was talking about like 100 feet or so for some of these. But there were many different designs. Some could be larger, some could be smaller, depending on their mission. I do now recall that he was talking of that he kind of did have a slide during the kind of video interview we did where he showed one of the craft that was a surveillance craft, and he said that was like 50, 60 feet.
There was also something else interesting that I saw, which was that one of them was named the USS Acres. And I want to check. Was that after Frank Peek Acres, the commander of the USS Saratoga in 1945?
That one I don't know.
Yeah, I just thought that was totally interesting because he actually named the craft. And anyway, more on that when we come back. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Dr. Michael Sala is our guest. Whistleblowers, Secret Space Program, and your phone calls next. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM.